Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honors. This case raises an important question of whether an interlocutory appeal lies from the denial of a statutory stay under the Civil Forfeiture Reform Act, CAFRA, and when the trial court denies the stay and the claimant, appellant, takes the position that this does impact his Fifth Amendment right. So we're talking about the denial of a stay for a statutory and a constitutional right.
But isn't the grant or denial of a stay more of a procedural matter that is appealable at the end of the litigation? I mean, his Fifth Amendment rights may be implicated, but absent showing that there is an open criminal investigation or prosecution, the Fifth Amendment doesn't typically excuse a claimant from proceeding with civil litigation, does it?
Your Honor, my response would be this. In this particular case, well, to answer your question directly, I take the position this is not just a procedural or a scheduling matter. We're talking about an individual right. In this particular case, the chronology is important. This may take a second to answer your question, but the notice of appeal from the denial was in April of 2012. In May of 2012, there was a criminal case which was filed in the District of Massachusetts, which related to the defendant's older brother. It talked about him as part of a 12-defendant case, receiving a suitcase, which was subsequently intercepted by the police in his possession, which had $210,000 and a few dollars in it. Now, at the time that we had requested the stay, the arrest of his brother had taken place, but there had been no actions filed. After the stay, there was actually a criminal case. And so this points out, if the court would look at...
Haven't you been assured that there won't be a criminal prosecution?
I was assured there wouldn't be a criminal prosecution in the state of Illinois or in the Northern District of Illinois. And specifically in the transcript, and I would direct the court to page 5 of the appendix and page 6, we had requested a brief short stay so that we could conduct discovery to see if there was a related case.
You mean in Massachusetts?
In Massachusetts, which would affect this defendant. And the reason why we think that, or we argue that waiting till the conclusion of the case is not effective is that while, yes, this court could reverse the forfeiture action, it couldn't say to the District of Massachusetts and the defendant, well, sorry, you can't use those statements either. Those would have been statements, if he made them, to protect his interest in the money that could be used to tie him into the District of Massachusetts case and to prosecute him and convict him.
So wouldn't it be your burden to establish that there's a case in Massachusetts? You know, of course, the stop occurred 3 years ago. There was an open criminal investigation. You would think you would know about it.
Well, we didn't. We knew that there had been a seizure. It's not part of this record, that the case was subsequently filed on May 12th after the notice of appeal had been filed in this court, in the interlocutory appeal request. And that is, the complaint was filed on May 24th, 2012. That's 1:12MJ05117-JGD. And the indictment was filed on June 21st, which was 1:12CR10196GAO, which charged the brother with money laundering. The complaint speaks of traveling from Montreal to Boston and then engaging in money laundering. The facts in this case were that, which we could point out to the district court, that the vehicle that the appellant was driving
But my question,
yes, Your Honor,
perhaps I was inarticulate, is aren't you improperly trying to shift the burden to the government to disprove the existence of something in Massachusetts?
Well, what we had really asked for was a stay so that we could investigate and bring before the court a related proceeding. Court didn't give us that opportunity. As facts later bore out, there was a related investigation. So I understand the court's position that the burden, why isn't the burden on the person asking for the stay? I would indicate that most of the cases that would say that were pre-CAFRA cases prior to 2000, when 18 U.S.C. 981G was enacted.
Should you be up in Massachusetts?
Pardon?
Should you be in Massachusetts?
Whether the forfeiture was brought in the Northern District of Illinois, we were just asking for a stay so that if the claimant would not have to be put to the burden of either asserting his Fifth Amendment privilege or incriminating himself in what turned out to be a later proceeding. The government was very artful in saying there is no investigation in the state of Illinois or in our office in the Northern District of Illinois. But there was a DEA investigation. There was a wiretap that started about a month after this stop. And that was the dilemma that the claimant ended up being in. So I don't know if that answers your question specifically, but the forfeiture was here, so this was the only forum to raise it in. There wasn't an actual case at the time that the request for stay was made or the interlocutory appeal was requested. The reason why we think an interlocutory appeal lies under 28 U.S.C. 1292A1 is because what is created by the order which denied the stay was putting the claimant in the very dilemma that the enactment of CAFRA and this particular statute was meant to prevent. Any further questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lean. Mr. Ebert?
May it please the court, Matthew Ebert on behalf of the United States. Let me begin at the outset, if I may, on addressing this issue of the state of Massachusetts and what may or may not be happening in that forum. I think it warrants emphasis that much of the discussion we just heard today is simply not in the record. It is not part of the record below, and in fact, as the government understands, the time frame announced today for the first time by the claimant, the action, whatever it may be, in the District of Massachusetts began some 3 months after the claimant here filed his motion for a stay of proceedings. And the statutory requirement is clear that it's at the time a party moves the court for a stay, is there or is there not a pending criminal case or investigation. And again, to be clear, as the government understands the timeline announced today, there may have been something that came to pass in a different district, but it was months after the relevant time period here.
And so you're saying that because of the passage of time, he shouldn't be able to present what he learned of. later under any circumstances.
Yes, but more than that, not in the record is anything about this Massachusetts action.
No motion was filed or anything to indicate there was something going on in Massachusetts.
That is correct. There was no motion. There was
so
nothing.
He did have a vehicle to bring that to the attention of the court.
And he did not do so. That is right. Yes, Your Honor.
Would he be able, as a private citizen, to ask law enforcement agencies in Massachusetts whether they had an open criminal investigation of him?
The government is aware of no reason why that would be a prohibition for him to do so. But regardless of this issue with Massachusetts and the fact that it's not in the record, also undeveloped is whether or not it even fits the definition of a related case or investigation. And 981G4 defines what that is. And it goes on to detail that you have, you know, the same conduct at issue, the same facts, the same parties. I believe it may
Well, isn't it the same suitcase?
Your Honor, frankly, the government does not know. Based on the description offered for the first time today, it's different individuals. So it's not even clear that whatever this subsequent action is meets the definition of the same case or investigation.
Well, I mean, it looks like he's one of the 12, you know, to share.
The government is not aware that the claimant is one of the 12, and I don't believe that the claimant indicated today that he was. Rather, it was a brother that I believe was mentioned.
Well, no, but he said that Mr. Al-Sharif is one of the 12 mentioned. I think you said that. Thank you. I did.
But, of course, that's part of the problem here. We don't have any record.
There is no
so
record.
We're trying to
this.
Get things clarified, and we don't have a record. He had an opportunity to create a record in terms of, you know, whether or not he got something official from as a individual citizen or not. He certainly had indication that this wiretap went up and these kinds of things, and never brought that to the attention of the court.
Yes, that is correct. It was never brought to the attention of the court, and the time frame announced today indicates that, somewhat contemporaneous with the notice of appeal, the claimant was aware of some issue in another jurisdiction and nonetheless did not bring it to the attention of the district court. So that is correct. It is not in the record. If I may, as the initial threshold question here of jurisdiction, it is the government's position that the nature of this order, which is a procedural order in the government's estimation, does not fit any of the avenues to confer appellate jurisdiction, either by statute under 1292 or doctrinally under the collateral order doctrine. And claimant, frankly, offers no argument to this court on how it might fit into any of these different avenues.
Well, if a denial of a stay in a civil forfeiture proceeding is not immediately appealable, why doesn't that force a person to make the choice that the stay provision isn't designed to prevent? That is, to either exercise their Fifth Amendment rights and hurt the civil case or waive them and hurt the criminal case. Why isn't it?
In part, to directly answer that, there is no criminal case here.
Oh, but I'm just saying theoretically.
Theoretically could create a dilemma. But it's not a dilemma that was present at the relevant time that matters here, which is what is required.
So you're saying that if a criminal proceeding had been pending, then it would have been appropriate to appeal?
Yes.
An immediate appeal would have been appropriate.
Yes, and I think that 6250 Ledge Road, Egg Harbor, Wisconsin, which is a Seventh Circuit case, is informative on some of these issues. And there was a pending criminal matter. The civil forfeiture proceeded. One of the issues in that case was whether or not there should have been a stay granted. The district court denied the request for a stay. It proceeded on the merits, and there were cross motions for summary judgment, and after judgment was entered, then the claimant, who did not prevail, filed an appeal on numerous grounds challenging the forfeiture action, including challenging the stay decision. So I think that demonstrates why there is not appellate jurisdiction here, because that issue of the stay order denial could be reviewed after final judgment was entered, as it played out in that case.
I don't really understand that. Why wouldn't the denial of the stay do irrevocable damage to the defendant if it turned out that the only way he could defend against the forfeiture would be to incriminate him criminally, right?
It would do damage to his ability, right, to meet his burden. And that, Your Honor, we believe is a consequence of asserting the right. And absolutely, it is an important right. It's implicated in this action, and he has the right to do so. But by doing so, then he must bear the attendant consequences of potentially failing to meet his burden of proof.
Boy, that sounds like a catch-22. Is it?
Invoking?
Seems circular.
The choice.
Yeah.
I mean, a collateral order doctrine, it really just requires irreparable harm, right? If you have an interlocutory order that cannot possibly be corrected after the final judgment, then why wouldn't you allow an appeal?
Well, I believe it could be corrected after judgment. I believe that's how it played out in the case that I...
No, because the problem is, in order to avoid implicating himself as a criminal, he may not be able to make his argument in the district court against the forfeiture. And then he's lost his chance forever unless he's able to appeal from the denial of a stay.
And I mean, it's the government's position that the claimant could assert the privilege or not assert it, and either way, still appeal post-judgment.
But I don't understand that. So suppose he says, yeah, this forfeiture is erroneous, but this money is lawfully mine. But if I start explaining why I think it's lawfully mine, I'm going to be providing evidence against myself in this criminal prosecution, and that prevents him from. And then there's no way he can. And suppose he's acquitted in the criminal case, but there's no way he can go back and fight the forfeiture. And I don't see why that should be permitted.
Under the scenario described, yes, that the government concedes that certainly creates a difficult position for any claimant in that spot.
Well, what's on the other side?
What is on the other side of that equation?
Yeah.
Would be...
takes a fifth, loses.
I mean...
There's no big hurry about the forfeiture. The government has the money.
Right.
It can invest it. It can speculate with it if it wants. So why does it care about a delay? I mean, I suppose the delay could become unreasonable, but if it were some, finite delay in litigating the forfeiture action, how would the government be harmed?
The government would not be harmed by a delay in the forfeiture. Alternatively, if I may, even if the court were to disagree and decide that there is, in fact, appellate jurisdiction, then alternatively, it is the government's position that the district court committed no error in its application of the relevant statute on whether or not there should have been a stay here. There are three criteria set out, and based upon the record developed and before the district court at the time that the stay motion was rendered, the district court found clearly, based on the information it had, that this claimant failed to meet those criteria.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Ebert.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Lean,
why didn't you file something?
Well, there were some problems, Your Honor, but I would just respond that.
No, I mean, I'm asking why haven't you?
Well,
when you learned that this investigation was going on in Boston, why wasn't something filed?
We didn't know it at the time that we filed the notice of appeal, although we knew that there was an investigation. I would, Felix Frankfurter once said, wisdom often never comes, so we ought not to criticize it when it comes late. So
you never went to the government and said, you know, I've learned this information, I filed my notice of appeal, can we have an agreement here that, you know, we stay the filing of the appeal, or I'll withdraw the appeal because the district court has lost jurisdiction, and let's go back to the district court and find this out. Nothing was done like that.
No, Your Honor. The only thing that we did do, though, with the district court was tell the district judge that this case started in Boston with the rental of the vehicle, and we wanted the opportunity to
investigate. Yeah, but what I'm saying is you have some information, apparently, now.
Yes.
That something is pending.
Yes.
And nothing was filed. All I'm saying is, all I'm saying is a step of talking to the government, saying this is what we have, I'm willing to file an affidavit or file something to show how we got this information, so we might as well not go up to the Court of Appeals, waste time up there. I just can't imagine the government, if they found out that was valid, would not let him exercise his rights and not agree to a voluntary stay.
Well, we think the government deliberately wrote the letter that they wrote assuring us that there was no...
No, but they can't make promises for anybody else.
No, they
can only make promises for Illinois and the Northern District of Illinois. Yes. They can certainly inquire in Massachusetts, but they can't make a representation about what's going to happen in Massachusetts. You have to get that from Massachusetts.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would differ from the prosecutor that a private citizen could in any way find out the status of an investigation or their particular
crime. And I appreciate that could be difficult, but I'm just saying going to the government with the information you had would hopefully cause the government to at least check to see. Because you said there had been a grand jury investigation.
Hopefully, Your Honor. Just to answer...
So you had to have some basis for saying there was a grand jury investigation open. So an affidavit gets filed or something to that effect. Yes, that goes to the government. The government can run it down. I mean, the grand jury had to take place somewhere, either the state court or the federal court.
Well, we felt that the government, we conclude the government knew about this all along and put the defendant to this Hobson's choice. To answer Judge Rovner, I didn't mean to indicate this claimant, defendant, appellant was charged there. His brother was under similar circumstances in Boston where the claimant in this case rented the vehicle and started driving cross-country. So there was a significant time.
Was it the same
time.
Money? Was it the same money?
It wasn't this. I don't know if it was the same source of money, but it wasn't the same money that they seized from him, a different sum of money. And that was...
I just want to...
Yes.
Understand something. I must have... I obviously misheard you, but I thought you said there were 12 other individuals?
It was a 12-individual indictment of a large investigation that started with a wiretap in October of 2011, a month after this seizure, which started in September 1st of 2011.
And your client is not mentioned among those two?
No, he is. Okay. He is not mentioned in
all right,
that.
Yeah, I did miss it. Thank
but,
you.
But we submit that were he to testify regarding this sum of money, it would be directly tied in to the money laundering count that his brother was charged with a month and a half after we filed our notice of appeal.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lean.
Thank you.
And
thank
Mr. Ebert. And the court will be in recess.